Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Women's Wednesday here on Mind Talk. Every Wednesday, you and I have the opportunity to meet another woman who has agreed to share her path, her story. Today's guest is Millie DRX. Millie, did I pronounce your name correctly?
Yes, you did. Thank you, Pamela.
Okay, I'm very pleased. Now, Millie was diagnosed with lupus at the age of 31. And her book, Befriending the Wolf, The Guide to Living and Thriving with Lupus, is actually her chronicle of her journey with lupus. And before Millie and I get into that, I just want to share with you some information from the Lupus Foundation of America that has estimated that 1.5 million Americans and 5 million people worldwide suffer from lupus, 90% of whom are women. 65% of lupus sufferers experience chronic pain, and 50% have emotional problems relating to the disease. Millie, you've named your book Befriending the Wolf. Why?
Well, the wolf, because lupus is wolf in Latin. In the Middle Ages, they thought that the bruises caused by lupus were wolf bites or similar to wolf bites. So they called it lupus, this disease. And the way I found peace with it was by befriending the disease. That's why I think of it as my little pet wolf inside my body. And it's as long as it's kept quiet and happy, he's fine and he doesn't act up. So that's why it's called Befriending the Wolf.
Okay. We don't want him to act up.
No.
Acting up makes it very difficult. Tell us what your life was like before you received the diagnosis of lupus, which, as I indicated a moment ago, did not happen until the age of 31 for you.
Yes, it did. My life before that was pretty normal because I didn't know that I had an illness. I was always more tired than everybody else, but since I didn't know the difference, I thought it was normal. And I did have little flares, but they were never diagnosed because they only acted up in certain parts. For example, my skin would get all red, or I would have a fever, or my joints would act up. So for every single of those flares, I went to a different doctor. I went to the dermatologist for the skin, and I went for the joint, with a sports doctor to operate on my knee. And it never added up, because that's what lupus does. It just attacks everything or different things. So it's very difficult to diagnose. That's why I think many people have this disease and they don't even know about it, because it's very difficult to diagnose, because it can attack anything at any time. So before I was actually diagnosed, I thought I was perfectly fine. I thought I had less energy than everybody else, but I just thought it was normal for me. So I didn't actually know what it was, but I think it's very common for people who have lupus to only be diagnosed when they have a flare with four or more symptoms acting up at the same time. So they get diagnosed with lupus. And it's only when you get sufficient symptoms acting up at the same time that they actually do the test that's called an anti-nuclear antibody testing, and they only do that in the States, in the Mayo Clinic. So it's not an easy test to do, at least not in Mexico. So when they did that, and they said, okay, well, you do have lupus, they confirmed the diagnosis. But it was only until I got a really, really active and like all-inclusive flare that they could actually diagnose me.
Well, what were the symptoms that took you to the doctor?
It started with a fever. I thought it was a flu. And then the next day, I was completely, my whole skin of my whole body was like burned, as if I had, I don't know, fried myself in oil or thrown myself hot water or something. It even had like the little water things, the pustules that they come out when you get burnt. I was all burnt. And then the next day, I could not move one joint in my body. They were all so swollen, I couldn't move. And by the next day, it had eaten up all my muscles. I didn't have leg muscles. I didn't have arm muscles. And still, we didn't know what to do because this was Christmas time. And there were, I was in a little town where my parents live. It's called Cuernavaca. And, well, the good doctors were off on vacation. But we found one, and he was a geriatrist because his patients are old people, so they tend to get sick in the winter. So we found him, and when they took me to him, it was already attacking my spinal cord and my central nervous system. So he actually said, he was the one that diagnosed me. He said, this sounds really horrible. It's a very active flare. You have about 2 or 3 days to live.
What? 2 or 3 days to live?
Yeah, he said, put your affairs in order. There's nothing to do. And he gave me just massive cortisone. And I mean massive. He was giving me 100 milligrams of cortisone a day, plus all kinds of immunosuppressants to suppress the immune system. And he actually saved my life. But he thought I wasn't going to live through it because I was so deteriorated. Fortunately, it attacked only the moving muscles, the leg muscles and the arm muscles, and it didn't go for the heart or the lungs because I would have died.
Now, this is at Christmas time. You live in Mexico City, so the fact that you would be with your folks in a town apart from where you're living, I mean, that was a typical behavior for Christmas time, was it not?
It was, yes.
Okay.
And so, I had a baby boy. He was born 2 months before that. He was born in October. And that's what caused the flare, because it also has to do with female hormones. And when you have hormonal ups and downs, it tends to flare. That's why pregnancies are really, really difficult, and you tend to lose a lot of babies. I had already lost 4 babies, but the gynecologist didn't know why. He thought I was unable to have children. But I'm a little stubborn, so I persevered in the fact of getting pregnant. And I had already 1 son, and he was born fine. And that pregnancy went fine, so it didn't raise any alarms. But in the second one, after he was born with the hormones going down and acting up, I just had this massive flare. And the whole damage was caused in less than a week. And I was in bed for 6 months. I couldn't even move. I didn't have any muscles.
That is such a whirlwind and such a rapid change, an explosive change in how you experienced yourself and your life. What did you do with the diagnosis of lupus? How did
At
you
the
feel
moment,
about it?
Yeah. I was completely in shock.
Okay.
And I felt so ill that it didn't even register emotionally. When they told me you're going to die, I said, okay, fine. I couldn't even feel. I was so sick, I didn't have any emotions in me. I think that was the most difficult part of it all, because I couldn't feel anger, I couldn't feel regret, I couldn't feel sadness. I was just like in such shock that I was insensitive to everything. I think that the diagnosis registered like a few months later, maybe a few weeks at least, that I started saying, okay, I think this is really... When I started feeling better with the cortisone and the immunosuppressants, that's when it registered. Because before that, it was just so shocking, couldn't even register.
And sounds like you were consumed with so much pain that it makes sense that it wouldn't have registered. How did your family respond to this diagnosis, particularly with the doctor telling you had 2 days to live?
Oh, they were completely terrified. My mother was just... up in arms, and but my husband wasn't even with me. He was in Mexico City with his family. He had just come back to leave his mother at home because she went to spend Christmas Day with us, and he had come back to leave her in Mexico City. And he was here when my mother called him and told him this, so he went back immediately, and they took me to all sorts of specialists and to do all kinds of tests. Nobody wanted to really believe that this was actually true, that I had an incurable disease and that it might kill me like in 2 or 3 days. So they were all in denial and running around like crazy all around me. I couldn't even decide for myself. So it was fine that they could run around and take me here, and they took blood all over the place and all kinds of tests. for days and days and days until I finally said, okay, this is enough tests. I think enough doctors have said I have lupus. I think I have lupus. Please stop taking me to doctors and specialists, and because it was really tiring and horrible.
Well, it certainly sounds like it. Now, so once you really acknowledge that you had this diagnosis, you had this disease, and you didn't die in two or three days, what kinds of feelings began to set in at that point, at the point that you essentially took ownership of having this illness?
I think the first one was a very deep depression, because I thought this was going to be the rest of my life. I thought just bed, and they said no more sunlight. Even the artificial light was painful on my skin. So I thought, okay, this is the rest of my life. I'm going to spend it in bed in a darkened room. I couldn't be visited by people because I was having so many immunosuppressants that any virus or bacteria could kill me. So even my kids were allowed in just for a few minutes just to give me a kiss. And that was so depressing, and no sunlight, no anything, just drawn curtains, dark room, quiet, keep her quiet because any emotion can trigger this. And that's no life, to be perfectly honest with you. So one day, after many weeks of depression, I started to get angry. And finally, when I could feel the anger, that gave me the strength to fight. And that was, I think that was the moment that I started sort of doing things for myself a little by little and getting myself back on track. But it was until I could feel anger. Before that, it was just depression, and I was just lying there like a cushion, I think. I just on feeling, just lying there. The nurse would come in and take me to the bathroom and bathe me and put me back in bed, and my hair was falling out, and it was and cortisone was making me so big because it was just massive doses. So my cheeks were completely swollen and my back was, it was getting big by the second. And it was first depression, then anger, and then I could start fighting for myself and start to try moving. I wasn't even interested in trying to move because I couldn't get out of my room. And then when I got angry, I decided this is no way to live. I refuse to live like this. I'd rather die. It's better than just being here, lying here. Just imagine listening to my children outside a closed door, and they were playing around, and I could hear them crying, and I could hear them playing, and I just couldn't move or do anything. It was no life.
Not at all.
Not at all. So the day I decided I'd rather die than do this, I started to move first little by little, and then I had to regrow all the muscles. And I had to restart to walk. And I think my first, I think that's even in the book, that my first big breakthrough was grabbing a glass of water and drinking it. Of course, I threw it all over myself, but I could actually grab the glass of water. And then putting my legs down from the bed. Oof, that took me forever. And then the pain, it was like needles in my feet when they finally came down. It was excruciating pain. But I said, I don't care about the pain. I'd rather do this and be able to do something than to live like this. I just refuse to do this.
It, as you describe the flares that you were having, it sounds like it was actually the disease, the illness, was attacking your entire body.
My entire body.
From head to toe.
The doctor said.
Yeah. Your hair was coming out.
It was just a massive attack.
Yeah. It sounds like it. Hair coming out, your feet. I mean, literally from head to toe. There was pain and discomfort everywhere.
Yeah.
And then at one point you say that even if it's an incurable disease, there are ways to live a full life despite having this.
Precisely. That's what I thought that would be the best way after getting angry and after going through all the phases of, you know, why me? I've been a nice person all my life and all these sort of grieving stages, because it was a grief. Actually, the me I knew before had died, and this new me that couldn't do all these things, the list of no's that the doctor gave me was just an incredibly lengthy list. It was, you can never be in the sun again. You can never have a strong emotion again. Imagine being the mother of two kids. You can never have a strong emotion. How do you do that? It's right. impossible. It was just insane, the list of no's. Everything I couldn't eat, everything I couldn't do. And I said, I need to redefine myself and redefine this illness, because if I continue thinking along these lines, the depression is just going to be too much and it's going to kill me, literally. Right. So that's the way I began. I already knew that thought patterns create emotions. So I started by the definition of lupus, and I said, okay, it is an incurable disease, but incurable disease just sounds so hopeless. So I said, okay, this is a condition my body has, first things. I will take away the illness and call it a condition. And then I will go for the incurable. It's not curable, but it is manageable. So would you just have to... That's what I thought. If I have lived 31 years with this, and it's never been more than a discomfort, why can't I get back to being like that? So that's what I was working for. And actually, in the path to doing that, I got even better than I was before, because now I know my body much better. So I know when I'm doing anything that it's going to trigger it, it gives me the signs. It gives everybody the signs, but we just don't know what the signs are, so we don't listen to our bodies. So that was the first step. Redefining the condition, started thinking more positively, and starting to know my body again and what triggered it and what didn't and what I could do and what was too much for me. And it was a very long learning curve, because I had a lot of other flares after that. Every time I thought I was cured, I got another flare because I overdid it. I'm a very active person. I hate to be lying down. So I always, I just have a lot of enthusiasm in life. So I like to do things. And I tended to overdo it until I got to know my body sufficiently well to find balance. So that's sort of the recipe I found for me, that I have to be balanced in body, in mind, in emotion, and in spirit. I actually became a very spiritual person after this, because it's just, that's the dimension that gives hope in life.
Now, just as you were describing changing the way you were talking to yourself about the diagnosis from incurable disease to manageable condition, even just switching the words around has such a profound, somewhat calming effect on what you're experiencing.
It does, doesn't it? I think the definition of something makes you either feel more or less good about it or horrible about it. Incurable disease just sounds so hopeless. I'm in a hole and I will never ever get out of here. Manageable condition, okay, I have a condition. Many people have conditions, all sorts of conditions, and they can live. So why shouldn't I be able to live with this condition? And I found that I could. Took me forever. Took me my little son, the one that was born then, he's already 15 years old.
Wow.
So I think my last flare was about, 3-4 years ago?
Huh.
No, more like five, six years ago.
Wow.
Was my last flare. The flares started being less acute and shorter because I wouldn't let myself get so ill. What I found with me was that when I was overdoing things, I couldn't stop myself in time and until I got to know myself sufficiently well. And now I can stop myself in time before the flare gets too much. Because the body, what I thought, it's just like a metaphor for my immune system. I think of it as, of course, it's the army in my body. And I have just a general that just gets panicky and he's paranoid and he's a little crazy. So when this general gets triggered, he just declares all out war on anything he sees. So what I have to do is keep this general easy and peaceful and happy, because if he gets angry, everything goes nuts.
Millie, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, I'd like to talk more about the triggers that you identified.
Perfect. Okay.
Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We will be back in just a moment. Millie, you talked about triggers. Talk about what that means and what your triggers were.
Okay, triggers are certain things, usually in the environment, that make this disease go. The strongest one for me is hormones, as I already talked about, and that was the one that made the biggest flare. So every time the menstruation cycle, pregnancies, everything that has to do with female hormones, it's a big trigger, and people with lupus have to be really careful around those times. So around that time of the month, I usually take it easy, and I rest a lot, and I'm very aware of my body so that nothing will get triggered. Also, the sun. The sun is one of the biggies, and everybody with lupus is triggered by the sun, I think. I think it's one of the universal triggers for lupus. So not being in the sun, always wearing long sleeves, hats, sunglasses. I'm also allergic to sunblock, so that's not fun. But people that are not allergic to sunblock should wear sunblock all the time. I usually just dress and look for the shade. But I'm able to be outside now, just with a hat and glasses and all these kind of protections. Okay. Also, being very tired is one of the big issues. So strong physical activity, like hard sports for me, are just out of the question. So for exercise, I do very low impact things like swimming or yoga. That's all I can do, because if I get really tired physically, I flare. Also, things that cause allergies, allergenic foods or substances. My skin is very sensitive, so I had to change soaps with which they washed my clothing, and I had to find out which foods were triggering me, which weren't. So my diet had to change. I even became vegan for a while because I had to take away everything and then start reintroducing foods that I was usually eating to see what would be good for me and what wasn't. Also, there are many things in the environment. One person I know that has lupus was allergic to the chemicals they were using in the field. She was living in the countryside. Mm. And the sprayed chemicals that they put in the crops, she was incredibly allergic to those, and she would flare every time they did that. So everything in the environment you have to be really aware of. Of course, other diseases, viruses and bacteria, trigger the immune system, so they can trigger a flare very easily. And, funnily enough, strong emotions. Strong negative emotions tend to trigger. For example, anger is the worst. If I get really, really angry and I don't say it or I don't do something to channel that anger, it can produce a flare. So it's very bad for us with this kind of illness to keep it to ourselves. So there are a lot of ways to channel anger in positive ways, and the easiest one is just go into your room and scream your head off and hit the pillow. That takes the anger off.
So you're
or
not saying,
if you're really sad, just go into your room and cry your eyes out. Just get rid of the emotion, channel it, express it, say it, because if you keep it inside your body, it's like this general, the crazy one we were talking about. he feels there's something wrong, but he doesn't know what it is, so he just goes on the rampage and attacks everything. That's the way I think about it, because it's funny that strong emotions trigger lupus.
It is interesting. Now, when you talk about a trigger and a flare, can you determine what the flare will be based on what the trigger was, or is it anything at any time?
It's anything at any time. Actually, the trigger just triggers this general, and then the general goes and attacks anything it finds in the way. And it can be really dangerous because it can attack any vital organ anytime. Fortunately for me, it's never been a vital organ. It's never gone for heart or for lungs or for the liver or the kidneys or the brain. So everything it's attacked as of today, it's only been the muscles and the skin and things that are not vital and recuperate. Because if it went for heart, for example, you could die in a couple of days. Or the brain, imagine the brain.
It's hard to imagine, I think, unless you've actually lived with it. Do you have a support group or a support mechanism where you're interacting with other folks who share your experiences?
I do, actually. I belong to a group online. It's called My Lupus Team, in which all people tell of their experiences, and we ask questions of each other, and we say, I'm having this symptom, has anybody had this before, how does this medicine work for you? And it's really nice to be able to communicate with people who actually understand this, because what I have found is that people that have never lived through this, it's very difficult for them to understand. It's one of the biggest issues is that people around you don't get it. Because, for instance, you can be fine one day and you can be out partying and you can be the life of the party, and then the next day you can't get out of bed. And I used to have problems with my husband with this, because he would say, oh, so when it's your party, you're having fun, and when it's my engagement, you can't get out of bed. I think that's just an excuse, for example. He would think it was an excuse that I didn't want to go with him, for instance. And I would say, no, I really, really cannot get out of bed. But unless you've experienced it in yourself, it's really hard to understand. So I think having a support group, it's really important for everybody not to feel like abandoned and misunderstood. It's horrible to feel misunderstood. So I've also started a group here in Mexico City, because in Mexico City it's not really known. It's, since it's a difficult disease to diagnose, it's not really well known, and there are no support mechanisms. So I started a group myself in which I'm teaching them everything that I learned through the years of all the alternative ways I found to keep myself well, to see what works for them, because not everything works for everybody. So I'm teaching them everything to see how it works. And from that, I intend to do like an online or something group in which I can give these tips to everybody to see what works and what doesn't. I think you have to try out a lot of things to see what works for you.
And the group that you've started in Mexico City, that's an in-person group?
Yes, it is. We meet once a week.
Okay. Well, that's wonderful.
I've become a therapist of all these alternative things because I've learned them all. And the things that work for me, I learned how to do. So now I'm teaching them so they can do it on themselves too.
That's wonderful. Talk a little bit more about the impact that this kind of an illness can have on relationships. And I say that in part from the perspective, you know, if you're in a wheelchair, for example, somebody understands that. But if you look fine, and as you said, the issue that came up between you and your husband, if you look like you're fine and you say that you're not, there's not as much support as one would like for dealing with whatever it is you're dealing with. I mean, that's certainly true with, you know, psychological issues. And certainly there's a huge psychological component with lupus. But what was the initial impact of your awareness of this illness on your marriage?
It was huge, and it's one of the things that we talk about in the group is that the people in my group just got separated because her husband just couldn't get it, and it's called an invisible disease, and because you look fine, actually, you look even better than everybody else, because we tend to get this really red cheeks, like a butterfly in the cheeks, so you look like you're not even not sick, because usually sick people look pale and wan, and we don't. We look rosy-cheeked and bright-eyed because you usually have a fever or low-grade fever. So we look even better. We look healthy and fine. It's like the definition of looking healthy. So it's very difficult for people to understand this. In my relationship, it has been strainful, and others have just broken up. It's difficult to understand, and it's also difficult for my children. Now they're grown up, and they know that their mother that cannot be counted on all the time. But when they were little, it was really hard for them to understand that sometimes I really couldn't get up and be with them or play with them or go out in the garden with them. It was really tough on them, and they just couldn't wrap their heads around it because, as you say, nothing looks wrong with me. So when I said I can't get up, it sounded like an excuse to them. Why? But you were up 2 hours ago. Yes, I was fine 2 hours ago, but right now I'm not fine anymore. And that's really tough for all kinds of relationships, sure, for friends too, because they invite you places and sometimes you can go and sometimes you can't, and they tend to get offended because, oh, you went to such and such a lunch party, why won't you come to mine? And they think that you're being rude to them, and it's really difficult for them to grasp it. And every time you pull out the lupus card, that's what they tell me, or you're pulling the lupus card again, it sounds like an excuse to them.
Yeah, that it just sounds so painful and so complicated on top of the physical difficulties that you're dealing with.
It is, because you feel unsupported. That's why I always tell people you need to have somebody that has the same thing to support you, because at least you know that somebody in the world understands you, even if the people around you don't. And it's also, you can't get angry at them because it's very difficult. I get it, that it's really difficult to understand if you don't have it.
What about work with a diagnosis of lupus? Do you find that the people in your support group or the people that are online, are they continuing to work? Or are they changing their career path?
Many, many are changing their career paths, especially if their careers were really straining on the body. For example, there was a nurse, and she just couldn't take the hours. So now she became a private nurse, like looking after people in their homes, and because in the hospitals, the shifts are just too long. And yes, many people have had to change their venues. I used to be a kindergarten teacher, and that was so stressful because I was in charge of the little ones. They were a year and a half years old, and you had to carry them all day. So I had to stop that. Now I'm a therapist, and I work in my time. I have my own consulting room, so I do the appointments, and if I have to cancel, I just cancel. But I'm not working for somebody else. So that's made it easy on me. And other people, yes, they have a lot of trouble keeping up jobs because sometimes you really, really can't get up. Office jobs are not so bad because you're sort of sitting down and you can be resting. But there's also a wonderful thing with lupus called lupus fog. And that's just like fog descending on your brain and you can't think straight. You can't even talk straight. So when you have lupus fog, an office job is just impossible. You can't write, you can't talk, you can't think straight. That's why part of the redefinition I invite people to do of themselves is, okay, you have this, you know the symptoms, now what do you want to do with your life, knowing who you are right now? Because if you try to keep on doing things that other people do, you're going to get so frustrated.
And you're going to have a flare.
Probably going to provoke a flare and be horribly frustrated with yourself because you got a flare. No win situation.
Do you recommend that those who are working and have this diagnosis tell their employers?
I would, but it does change the way people see you. And that's one of the big issues discussed, especially in the online group, if I should tell people or not tell people, because the attitude of people does change towards you. Well, I don't know why we do this, humans, but we tend to put what do you call them? When you just think of a person as an illness.
Yeah, we're
being branded.
We're good at putting labels,
people. So sometimes when you do tell your boss, he can lay you off because he will think maybe that you're not reliable and he can't count on you. Because if you say, okay, I'm sick again, and then I'm sick again, and then I'm sick again, he's going to say, okay, this person is always sick. I can't rely on her. Let's just get somebody else in the job. And that's always a big but about telling people, because they can change the attitude towards you. Of course, your friends have to know and your family have to know. But in the workplace, I think everybody should just decide for themselves, depending on the kind of job they have and the kind of boss they have.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because, I mean, certainly it can add to the stress if you've got a boss who all of a sudden is seeing you purely through the lens of the label that's attached to you by the medical profession.
It would, because instead of getting pressure off you because you're sick, I think it would add pressure on you because they would always be on the lookout for you to fail or for you to be unable to do things. So I think for me, since I tend to be stressed, I would try to make double the effort to prove that I can manage the job, and that would be even worse.
Right, that would add to your stress, and that would then be a trigger that would add to, that would create a flare.
I'm glad you said stress. Stress is one of the big, huge triggers we have. And stress is just such a jumble of emotions. It's difficult to manage. That's one of the things you have to get on top of really fast if you want to manage the disease, stress.
You talk about something called the essential triad. What is that?
Well, that's the balance I found. That's having my body feeling good and then the mental, emotional. For me, it's sort of the same because thoughts trigger emotions. So I put it in the same category, thought, emotion, and spiritual. I really recommend, I'm not spiritual in the sense of a religion, because I'm not religious in that sense, but spiritual in the sense of having hope and knowing that there's more to you than this body that doesn't work that well, that there's this, I don't know what you want to call it, whatever people want to call it, that there's a life energy or an essence or a soul or whatever, that there's more to you and that there is a purpose for everything in life. That for me has changed the whole attitude towards, because it's not like I'm being punished and I have this disease and I don't know why, because it can feel like a punishment. For me, the spiritual aspect is saying there's a purpose for everything and life has purpose in itself. So what I have to do is find my purpose in this life with what I have and with who I am, because this is just a part of me. I can't deny it. I can't cure it. I can't go around it. I just have to accept it, put it in my system and live not really despite it, but with it. So that's the aspect I take of spirituality, the hope and the purpose. For me, those are the two main ingredients. So for me, that's the triad. Your body has to be okay. I mean, don't take away all the triggers that you know of, like the substances we were talking about, or the foods, or the take it easy with the hormonal times. All those sort of things are physical things. So you have to take care of that, and you have to take care of your thoughts and emotions. And you have to have hope in life.
Millie, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to talk to you more about finding your purpose, because clearly that's something that you see as being very important and very powerful, and so many people don't even know what that means. So when we come back, that's where we'll pick up.
Okay.
Folks, stay where you are. We'll be back in just a moment. Thank you. Millie, finding your purpose, those are words that we hear an awful lot today. So what does that mean?
Well, for me, it means doing something that really fills you with joy. That's the main definition. Actually, this definition I get from one of my favorite teachers. She's called Chloe Wordsworth. She has this method called resonance repatterning, which is absolutely wonderful. And she defines purpose like something that just fills you up with joy. It can be anything, really. It can be from cooking the best chocolate chip cookies in the world or gardening, something that really fills your inner satisfaction, gives you joy. That's the first ingredient. The second one is something you can do. One of my friends in the support group, she used to run marathons, which of course she can't do anymore. So she has, one of the things I'm working with her is for her to find something that she can actually do that fills her with joy and that she enjoys doing. Because what I find is when I'm feeling really, really horrible and sort of lying there, this something gets me out of bed, gives me the motivation to get out of bed because I really enjoy doing it. For me, it's giving therapy. If I do resonance repatterning, I do Reiki, I do all sorts of energetic therapies, and it just fills me with joy to see the face of the person when they get this aha moment or when they feel better. And for me, that just gets me out of bed and gets me going because it fills me with joy. The third ingredient is something that gives your life meaning. So what I found as a purpose with having lupus was now I think of my body as a school body, like these cars where you learn to drive, that they're school cars. Well, my body is like a school body. And everything I try on myself, I learn, and then I can teach. So that gave my life and having this illness meaning for me.
How does one really go about trying to identify what their purpose is for them? Any recommendations?
Well, the first step is always, what gives you joy? What do you enjoy doing? It's usually the question that people have the hardest time with, because many people don't even know themselves well enough to know what they enjoy. But you can start by really simple things. In your day, in your whole day, what is your favorite part? What do you really enjoy doing? It can be walking your dog in the park. It can be playing with your children. It can be cooking Thanksgiving dinner for your family. So that gives you an inkling. If, for example, you really enjoy playing with your kids, okay, only your kids or all kids? Maybe you can do something with children because your kids are going to grow up. So maybe doing things with children, or you get clues, and it just, your body tells you what really, really, really makes you smile.
And that's the place to start.
That's the place to start, yes. And then you can build on that, or you can just stay there. Whatever level you want to do this at is fine. As long as you find something that you really like and that you can do. I have one person, for example, that she loves knitting. And that's what she does. Now she has even her small little company where she knits all these very cute sweaters for babies. And she just started selling to boutiques because she knits whenever she can because her fingers hurt because of the joints and everything. But when she can, she knits. And then she sells these beautiful tiny little sweaters for newborn babies. And she has found her purpose in that. I have found my purpose in therapy. Another person has found her purpose in cooking. She used to love doing sports and things, and now she enjoys cooking. But she can't cook for a restaurant, for example, because she can't take the hours. But what she can do is do, like, when she's feeling like it, she bakes cakes, and then she sells it to her friends. So she found purpose in that, and people enjoy her cooking. So it doesn't have to be... Purpose sounds so earth-shattering and big. It doesn't have to be big and doesn't have to change the world. You don't have to become Mother Teresa or you don't have to become Nelson Mandela. You can just be yourself in your house, but do something, really find something that gets you out of bed and gets you motivated, gets you going. Having that it's one of the big things that will make you feel better, even if you're sick.
You know, I'm glad you described it in that way, because you're right. So many people think about finding your purpose. It's got to be this big, amazing thing that, you know, nobody in the world has ever thought of. And clearly what you're saying is, no, that it's much smaller than that. It's what brings you joy and how you share that joy, it sounds like.
Exactly. And what I think also is, what legacy are you going to leave? For example, this person that knits the beautiful sweaters for the babies, she's leaving a legacy. It's not an earth-shattering legacy, but it's something she's leaving of herself. So also purpose, I think for me, has to do with how people are going to remember you when you're not here. Are they going to remember you like, oh, she did the best turkey for Thanksgiving, or she was so loving with children, or she knitted these beautiful sweaters. So also for me, purpose has to do with what are people going to remember you for? Because when you're really sick and you're lying in your deathbed, like I was, that's one of the things that makes you really sad. I was telling you, I used to hear my children outside of my room going about their lives. And one of the things I thought was, okay, if I die tomorrow, what are these kids, my children, going to remember about me? They're going to say, okay, my mom was. And there was this big blank after that was. So now there isn't. Now I have found something, and I have found something to fill in that blank. And that, for me, is very important, to know that I will be remembered for something, that I'm helping people, that I'm doing things for others. For me, service is one of my big motivators. I love it. So that, for me, is it. But it doesn't have to be service for everybody. It has to do with what you enjoy.
It's clear that your children are very important to you. Do your children ever worry that they might have what mom has?
They used to, but they're boys, and this is so much more common in girls. So I actually wanted girls, but now that I have the boys, I'm so happy they're boys, because in boys it's so uncommon. And up to now, they haven't had anything to do with it. So I think they're fine. They think they're fine. I've always told them this is not hereditary specifically. There is a hereditary trait in which people with autoimmune things tend to have people with lupus, but it's not hereditary in a direct sense. And since they're boys, I think they're fine. And I don't think they worry anymore. They used to, like, I don't know, 5 years ago, when they were really little and they saw me really sick, but I haven't gotten sick in a long time. So also that has diminished their anxiety about it. And they see me having a normal life. So even if they thought they could have it, I think they think I can manage it. If she can manage it, I can manage it.
That's wonderful. You talked about resonance repatterning. What is that?
Oh, it's just a wonderful method It's got to do with energy, but it's also for emotions, for example, for dealing with your emotions. For me, it's the method, and it's the one I base all my therapy on. And what Chloe did, she studied a lot of alternative therapies, and she just developed this amazing method that anybody can do, in which you come in with a problem, whatever that problem may be, and it takes you through all the steps to find the real cause of that problem. And when you find the real cause of that problem, the sort of founding stone of resonance repatterning, which is what gives it its name, is that whatever you have is something you resonate with, as if we were radios and we were tuned into a specific thing, and your energy, your body's energy, is tuned into that specific frequency. So what she does is, through alternative things and energy things, she changes the resonance you have for that problem. And when she changes the resonance, the whole problem just sort of disappears, because you're not resonating with it anymore. So what she thinks, or she found through her work, is that if you have a problem, you're resonating with your problem. And in order to take the problem away, you need to stop resonating with your problem. So that's what she does. And it's amazingly easy. It's actually so easy, sometimes people don't even believe it's possible. And, well, for me, it's been life-changing.
So it sounds like what you do is to take a look at what the person is connected to that's underneath the problem they've identified, and in shifting how they think about it, it shifts the feeling. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, sort of. And you also shift the energy. If you're in energy therapy and work, you'll find out, and actually this has been already proven by physics, that everything is energy. Even the atoms are not even particles, they're energy. So if you change the way you think about something, you change the energy in it, and you change the whole outlook. And it does change you, even in a physical level. It does. It works. It's almost like magic, because it works so incredibly easily that people think it's not possible that in just one session you have taken this problem that I have for 20 years. But it does work. Sometimes it doesn't work in one session, but it gets to the root of the problem. That's what I love about it. It gets to the actual root of the problem, and it's never the one you think, or usually never the one you think. It usually comes from something in your childhood, which is something even Freud knew about, that everything that happens in your adult life is something that you already carry from your infant years. And then you change it from there. You change the... It's like if your brain had a switch and it went, just triggered the on response for something, and you live the rest of your life with the on button. And what this therapy does is just go back and turn it off. And then the whole energy you had put into having that problem just disappears, and you put it in... She thinks of energy as if it was an investment, sort of like money. So if you have your money in the problem, you're going to have the problem. If you take the money away from the problem and you put it in the solution, you're going to have the solution.
So it also sounds as though when you're able to uncover the secret, if you will, that takes away the strength of the secret.
Of course. When you know the actual cause and you bring it into your conscious mind, it takes the whole power away from the thing that was bothering you in your unconscious. It's like having a stone in your shoe. It's just bothering you horribly, and then you take off your shoe, you take out the stone, and it's like, oh, that was what was bothering me.
And when you've removed the stone, you've removed the pain.
You remove the pain, and you can go on walking, and you don't even remember that you had the pain before, because it was just so, oh, when you find the stone, it was like, oh, that's it. Oh, no more stone. No more pain. I can walk. Wow.
You talk about letting go of the fear, and it seems that if someone is given a diagnosis that they are told they are going to live with for the rest of their lives, it would be very easy to be afraid. So how does one let go of what for many would be a very natural response?
It is a very natural response, and it's the first response you're going to have, and it's perfectly obvious and natural that you have that response. But after you accept what you have, I think accepting it is one of the big things you have to do, because when you accept it, it's like accepting that you have anything else. I don't know, like that you're going to be bald because your hair is falling out. At first, it might seem like really threatening, but when you get to know yourself and you accept what you have and you know your body, I think it's a process. It's not like just you throw it away like a used Kleenex. It's not, doesn't work that way. You have to go inside, get to know yourself, and as long as you start knowing how to manage yourself, the fear starts dropping off of its own accord.
Okay.
Because it's not useful anymore.
Are there particular medications that one would routinely be prescribed with a diagnosis of lupus?
Yes. The first one is cortisone, prednisone, I think it's called in the U.S. And it's the cornerstone of lupus treatment. There's also the immunosuppressants. And there's also, there's one drug that they give you that is for, usually for malaria. It's called Plaquenil, and it's, it doesn't let the platelets in the body stick. I don't know why the body's platelets stick, to be perfectly honest with you, but that's one of the big things they give you. And if you are having a lot of trouble, some doctors prescribe chemotherapy. Actually, this very famous singer, she's called Selena Gomez. She has lupus, and she got chemotherapy for her lupus. I think it was attacking her kidneys or something, and she got chemotherapy for that, and I think she's much better now. But it's very aggressive treatments usually.
So there are medications, and one should expect to be given one or more of them with this diagnosis.
Yes. And then you have all the drugs that take away the secondary effects of the primary drugs. So you get the prednisone, but then you also need things to line your stomach because it can ulcer your stomach because it's so strong. And then you get the immunosuppressants, but then you have to have other drugs to take or to alleviate the secondary effects of the primary drugs. They're really strong drugs, all of them.
Which makes sense. But again, if you see that as part of the tools that you're using on a daily basis, perhaps you have a different level of resistance, if any, to taking the drugs.
Of course, you should take the drugs as long as you need them, of course. But then there are other drugs that you can start lowering. If you don't have a flare, there's no reason to continue having the drugs. At least that's what I found. So you can diminish the amount of drugs you're taking. For example, the prednisone, you can even have a perfectly normal life with 5 milligrams of prednisone.
Okay.
Instead of 100. 100 does give you all kinds of horrible side effects. But five is very manageable. And as long as you keep your immune system in check, the amount of drugs you're going to need are, of course, less. And doctors are usually really nice about this, and they work with you, and they lower your dosages when you don't need them anymore, and they increase them when you do. So it's not a permanent dosage for everybody. And then you find, like, your own dose in which you're fine, and you can manage it. And if you get a flare for some reason, you just have to increase the dosage and feel better. And when you feel better, you can lower it again. And it's this game with the illness in which you have to find the balance between everything you're doing and sort of swim through it.
Millie, there's so much to your story, and I think so much hope and opportunity for folks to really learn about the illness and about your journey. Let us have the website for Befriending the Wolf.
It's called Befriending the Wolf, and I have a blog there in which I share a lot of information about the disease and about the ways you can manage it. So there's a blog there, and there's also a Facebook page also called Befriending the Wolf. I just put the same name in everything so I won't forget what it's called. And I also share a lot of information there, and you can comment and you can ask questions, and I have gotten a community going of people that are asking questions, so I write about that and about what people want to know. And it's been a whole journey doing this Facebook thing. I had never been in social networks before.
It is indeed a journey, but one that I know many people are grateful that you are now participating in. Millie DRX, author of Befriending the Wolf, The Guide to Living and Thriving with Lupus. Thank you so much for your time with us today, Millie.
Thank you so much, Pamela, for the opportunity.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced daily by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. You can listen to Mind Talk on demand by going to myndtalk.org, or you can download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes store. To be in touch with me directly, you can always send an email to pamela@mindtalk.org. And then you must always remember, if it's unacceptable, then that's what it is, unacceptable. You take care.